Welcome, friends, to the River of Suck. We have a very special guest here for episode 31. His name is Julian Carr, and he's a pro skier. Zooming in from in front of a picture of Alyeska, I think. Are you in Colorado right now?
Yep, I'm up in Alma.
Oh, nice. Beautiful over there.
Yeah, love it.
Nice. Well, welcome to the River of Suck podcast, where we talk about fear and emotions and feelings. It seems to come up a lot in life, but especially in music, especially in skiing, and for any purveyors of haunted houses out there. So we have you here because you huck giant cliffs and you somehow wrap your mind around getting yourself over that literal edge. A lot of people talk about, you know, figurative edges they're trying to get past in their life, and you're going over the real ones. So yeah, appreciate you being here.
Definitely. It's always fun to, visit the topic. Cause I think there's a lot to kind of unpack. Obviously my pursuit and kind of the way I distill and utilize fear is, you know, an interesting experience, in the mountains, but I think we all have our own experiences with, you know, how we choose to kind of acknowledge fear and let it do its job and retreat, which we, 99% of the time should do. I think it's just interesting when we all do decide to push through it, whether that's a good idea or a bad idea. You know, like injuries might have happened, very, you know, like substantial ones, because you didn't listen to that, or you had breakthroughs and you found a way to utilize it. You might have experiences of both. I certainly have.
Wow. Love that. Well, I'm excited to dive deeper, but first I want to know a little bit more about you and share that with our listeners. Here's the question. The first question I ask everybody is, what makes you feel like your youest you, the youest you that you can be?
Being outside, mountain, and moving. I think moving in the mountains, that makes me feel very much, like I have purpose in life, and I have purpose in breathing and found a place in the world.
Right on. What does being a pro skier mean to you? Do you just, you get paid to go skiing, which is something that a lot of people, you know, that spend all their vacation time trying to do. How did you get here? What are you doing?
Oh man, I hear you. Ever since I was a little kid, I did a lot of team sports, loved like Joe Montana, John Elway, John Stockton and Michael Jordan, and loved skateboarding, back in like the Plan B, Mike Carroll, H Street Hocus Pocus days. And I think the, you know, individual, like representation of skateboarding and how the individuals were sponsored, how they had video parts, how they, existed in the magazines, how they kind of drove that industry. I feel like I started skiing in eighth grade and, immediately saw that skiing, at least back then, really lacked that kind of individual driving, the industry. It was very race oriented, and I really fell in love with skiing. And right away, you know, I started looking at magazines and movies and, realizing that there was a lot of space for, more individuals to be highlighted. And I definitely wanted to be one of the very few ones that were kind of in that arena. And so I kind of just slowly, you know, grinded. I was up skiing every single day. And, you know, by the time I got into college, I was going to school full time. Trying to figure out how to crack that code of being a professional skier, and working at a sports bar, full-time. So I kind of had like three very full-time things going on. And what I realized is that, you know, having a nice skill set at a sport, especially a niche extreme sport, is great. But if you want to be a professional at it, that's just it. You have to learn what those professional channels are. And what it means to be a professional in an industry. So I slowly started kind of learning what that meant, to be a professional and I found that I liked it and I gravitated towards it. And I will say that obviously at the end of the day, you're skiing a lot, but there's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes as far as, you know, being that professional. So I think that's where I found some success. And then, you know, I really gravitated towards, I've always loved big air. I've been in gymnastics my whole life. I love trampolines. I love foam pits. So once I felt powder growing up in Utah, you know, my association of a foam pit and powder wasn't much different. So I immediately just saw the mountains as a big foam pit arena. And if you could, you know, pick and choose correctly, you can go pretty big. And so I just kind of had this comfort zone I started no with doubt. Small and started growing it. And so I think my professionalism and my interest in a category that not a lot of people were interested in, which is big air, or actually I should scratch that. Everyone that puts on a pair of skis, they want to do two things. They want to go fast and they want to catch air. But both of those are inherently scary. So for me to slowly expand that comfort zone, you know, with that topic of fear, it's been a very, very intense journey and rewarding and fulfilling journey with fear. And I've been able to grow that comfort zone, kind of that just what I'm comfortable with. I went from a 5-foot jump, a 5-foot cliff to, you know, now being comfortable with a 200-foot cliff is an interesting path. I'm sure, you know, obviously it's kind of crazy to me that I'm that guy, but I also take the professional side seriously. And, it's just been an interesting journey of how to become a professional skier. And I can just leave it at that. It takes a lot of the professional side too, that you might not see too often.
Right. The hard work that everyone puts in that nobody really sees behind the scenes. They just see the big moment and the results of all the hard work, but really it's years, decades of preparation and showing up. So that seems to me like a good segue into the River of Suck analogy. So I hope that it makes sense to you. And I'm curious if you think this coincides with how you think about this. The River of Suck is an imaginary river that flows through our minds. And we're standing on one edge on our comfort shore. Behind us is our comfort cave. All the stuff that we already know how to do. All the stuff that's easy. We don't worry about. We can do it without thinking. Then across on the other side, the River of Suck, we can see little teeny versions of ourselves. They're teeny because they're far away, and they can do the things that we wish we could do now. But the problem is, in between us and that other side is a raging River of Suck filled with whitewater rapids, rocks, and thought piranhas. Thought piranhas, of course, those negative thoughts that just invade your brain, try to sabotage your good vibes as you're going towards your crazy goals that you're working towards, all that negative self-talk inside the brain. And so the idea is that you can't jump from point A to point Z without doing battle with yourself and with the learning process and giving yourself time to hit those little slices. You have to suck at something before you can be good at it. So that's the River of Suck. Does that make sense with your journey?
I love it. It's perfect. I mean, if you aren't willing to, you know, catch a current, go downstream, you know, dump your ship or get tangled in a tree and have to, you know, put your tail between your legs and climb up the shore and scratch yourself, you know, crazy journey to get back to where you first started, you know, it's definitely a challenging path, but even when you get a toe in, you know, and all of a sudden you're like, okay, at least I know the temperature of this water, you know, it's greatly fulfilling to make progress, even though you you're going to have a lot of setbacks. That's just part of that journey and why it's so rewarding and why, you know, I guess going from like, amateur to professional, it's like you work so hard at something that you finally get it right, you know. And I think once you get it, you craft your skill and now you can't get it wrong. And now, you know, you're on the other side of the shore looking back and being like, I'm so happy with myself because I believed in myself and I saw the vision of where I wanted to be, and I've been able to complete that. And that is, you know, trickles into not just sports and skiing, you know, it kind of trickles into your soul as who you are and how you navigate life with your relationships, with your, you know, your job, your just way you interact with people and the way you have humility and how to be grateful because you've had a challenging path and you know who you are. And I think with that inherently become a humble, you know, confident person.
Yeah. I love that answer.
Well, I love the analogy, man. It's great.
Let's dive straight into this cliff jumping thing, because the analogy of getting there and that process and journey from 5 foot to 200 foot cliff, it's just really interesting. And I want to know how you get there. First, let us know what your records are. Tell us about them.
Yeah. Yeah. So I call these baseball card stats. You know, my motivation and my enjoyment of cliffs is being out there, being in nature. I think cliffs are beautiful. I love to develop a relationship with them. And usually the bigger, the better. I think they're beautiful. I think flying through the sky is an incredible feeling. I think the visuals are unbelievable. And so afterwards, I always try to get a read, measurement on the cliff so that I have my baseball card stats, because the experience itself is what I love. But again, to be a professional, you need to be able to trade your baseball card. So to be able to, you know, have your way you can speak in a professional arena to create opportunities for yourself and to get plugged in for opportunities, you need these stats. So anyway, my largest cliff with an invert, I did a front flip off a 220-foot cliff in Engelberg, Switzerland. And I can tell you all about that story when I tell you about my journey. Another record I have is, you know, there's extreme skiing contests that have been going on the planet for 30, 40 years.
Yep.
And I have the record for the biggest cliff ever hit during a, you know, international contest. That was a snowbird. That was a 140-foot cliff.
Nice.
Yeah, so those are two pretty fun baseball cards to have, but both those experiences were profound and, you know, are kind of embossed into my soul forever. You know, I can relive those magical experiences along with, you know, hundreds of other magical cliffs. But those two obviously ended up having the baseball card stats that put those feathers in the cap.
I love that idea. My baseball card stat with skiing, of course, is that I'm the only person who's skied top to bottom at Silverton while playing the fiddle.
That is a very cool baseball card stat.
And it's great because no one else even cares enough to try it. So I'm feeling pretty secure right now.
That is cool. Well, what year was that? Was that in the last 4 or 5 years?
Oh, no. You know what? I think it was in 2013. 13 or 12, I can.
Isn't that frightening that that's 10 years ago already?
Oh my God.
Yeah. So on your baseball card, obviously that 2013 is going to have a sick little stat. I literally want to make a baseball card that has, like, you know, a full stat sheet with, I don't know what kind of categories, but there'd be highlights, you know, but go like full last like 15, 20 years. It'd be pretty hilarious.
It'll make us feel better about ourselves. That's right.
True.
So how is that different from the Jamie Pierre record? I notice one big difference is you're skiing away and he was landing on his head. So like,
yeah, so he did a 250-foot cliff, and so that's the world record for just, you know, cliff height in general. So this is about 30 feet bigger than mine. And his technique, obviously his choice of, you know, what maneuver, what aerial to pull, he decided to do a straight air. And, you know, my choice, my technique is always to do a front flip for my aerial so that I'm slicing through the air and I'm not leaving myself to be, you know, kind of affected, not at my choice of how the wind would place my body on my landing, you know? So with the front flip, you kind of cooperate energy with the angle of the snow and the angle of your body, and you can kind of just swan dive off the cliff and tip it over when it makes sense, so that you don't open yourself up to get hit by the wind. So obviously Jamie had great form. He looked awesome in the air for the first 150 feet, and then the last 100 feet, the wind kind of got his skis and, you know, put him into a compromising position when he landed. So again, I respect Jamie Pierre, and he was a lot of actually my inspiration to really focus on big cliffs. And so, you know, like I said, I have a lot of admiration and respect. I personally wouldn't have chose a straight air from a cliff that high, and I'm still very impressed with his vision and his execution. He still, you know, went for it and pulled it off, and it was incredible.
Yeah. Cool. I was wondering about that. The best part about your take on it is it's really your personality. The baseball card stat is you put your own spin on it. This is how I do this. And that's very much in how musicians think about our music. And like, we're doing things where other people have maybe played this song before, but how are we going to do it? And that's really where the fun begins.
With saying that, I've always thought, I'm not a musician, but I love music like crazy. My dad's a musician. He was a professional full-time musician raising me until I was about 13. Then it'd be kind of part-time for him, but he still has played in bands my whole life. But him and I have a lot of great chats because he doesn't ski. But he's like, man, it sure does sound like going skiing with friends is kind of like me and my buddies getting together to play music. You don't know quite where you're going, but you all have a big journey together. Maybe someone takes the lead on their mountain. They know where you're going, and you just have to kind of keep up and trust their flow. And he's like, this is great. He's like, I can kind of understand what that camaraderie is, and what that, you know, what, how rewarding that must feel. Cause I definitely see a lot of similarities with a group of people playing music as you do with a group of people skiing.
Totally. Yeah. I kind of think, you know, using the contours of the mountain to improvise where we're going to go and how we're going to move our bodies. To me, it feels very similar to improvising through music. So that is a cool thing that your dad said. I love it. Oh, yeah. Are you ready to share your story about hitting those giant cliffs?
I should probably just rewind and tell you a little bit about how I even decided I wanted to hit cliffs in the first place. Like I said, growing up, did a lot of gymnastics. I loved jumping on trampolines. I just loved catching air. It didn't matter how, I just wanted to. So started skiing, instantly started, you know, hitting jumps, finding little cliffs, and, you know, started skiing in eighth grade. So through all of high school, skiing 30, 40 days a year, maybe, and then got into college. And that's when I was like watching, like, you know, every movie and looking at every magazine. And just all I could think of was like, huh, like I should be able to figure out how to be one of those guys, you know, make a career out of this. And, you know, through that path, being 19, 20 years old or so, I kind of found that my comfort level at the time was around like a 40-foot cliff, maybe 50 feet. And, you know, I think in the ski industry, snowboard industry, exaggerating the height of what you did is unfortunately practice all the time, because a 40 or 50 foot cliff is gigantic. That is a big yeah. cliff. Too many people hit a 40 foot cliff and they call it a 60 foot or call it a 70 foot. My friend, you hit a 30 foot cliff. That's still gigantic. You should be psyched on that, but please don't call it a 60 foot cliff, because it just was not, you know. But anyway. I'm hitting 40-foot cliffs, and to even remotely think of hitting one bigger than that was just terrifying, right? So I'm skiing 150 days a year. It's all I want to do. I'm going to college at the University of Utah, and I am watching like every movie, and there's a guy named Jamie Pierre, and he is in every movie, every magazine, and he's hitting 100 footers routinely. And up until Jamie Pierre, you know, in the history of skiing, maybe five or six guys had hit a true 100 foot cliff, And of those five or six guys, maybe one or two of them did it twice.
Yeah.
That was it. And even, you know, one of them died trying it twice. And so, I mean, it's such a crazy thing. And just seeing Jamie Pierre in every magazine, every movie, I was like, how did this guy figure this out? How did he crack the code, you know? And all I could think of was like, man, if he could crack the code, like I can crack the code. Obviously, this code can be cracked. It can be. So, you know, that summer, there's this really cool 150-foot cliff that he had the vision and pioneered to hit in Wolverine Cirque in Utah. And I went up on that cliff. I found it in the summertime, and I just sat on the takeoff and like cross-legged and just tried to like chill out and, you know, close my eyes and breathe and just, you know, feel what it feels like to be up in that environment. It's at the edge of such an intense cliff. I just thought maybe I'd get some kind of peace of mind from that. And I can't say that I directly did, but I just wanted to, you know, have that intent to directly place myself in those places just to see what it would feel like in my body, you know? And
can you say what it felt like in your body when you first went up there?
You know, it was exhilarating, you know, all in the bubble of fear. And that, none of that enjoyment, none of that exhilaration was outside of fear. Like it was all contained in fear. You know, it was just something I couldn't touch yet. It was right there. I could feel it, but I couldn't touch it. I couldn't get through that fear mist. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Wow.
So it was all scary still, but very exhilarating. And so the whole next winter goes by, and oh wait, I need to even rewind a little bit more. So I'm way into skiing, 50 footers or max. And I, this one year, actually ended up getting some sponsors. It was the very first year I had sponsors. And I went to like preseason training like crazy. And I just felt like I could out-ski anybody. And I kind of had the 99% rule. And that was, you know, anything I tried to line up, I was 99% sure I could do it. I'd just go and I'd figure it out real time. If any, like, you know, trip, you know, if anything was trying to trip me up on the way down, I'd usually just figure out on my feet and it would work out. Or I'd have a couple spectacular crashes. And as you know, skiing is like the only sport where you can have a vicious crash and literally be fine and laugh off, you know? So I had a lot of those, you know. I was eating shit a lot, but going for it and pulling off some pretty crazy stuff, and most of the time pulling it off. And I got sponsors, and my first year with them, I'm going to take over the world mentality. And the first day of the year, Snowbird snowed over 100 inches over Thanksgiving weekend. So the first day the resorts opened, it was like, you know, late November. And I got up there, obviously, for first trim. I'm shredding around all day with my buds. You know, people start to take breaks. I don't take a break. pretty quickly during the day, I hit this line that was kind of like a double cliff. And high speed, highly consequential, lots of sharp rocks everywhere. And just aced it. So I'm feeling like a total boss the whole day. I really am skiing like maybe better than I've ever skied in my whole life.
It's like superhero style.
It totally was. I felt like one. And it's getting to be the end of the day, and I meet up with these two buddies that are kind of in a different friend group, and they're also really good skiers. And so I'm like, hey, got this line. Let's go check it out. So I wanted to kind of impress them and drop into this line that usually I probably wouldn't have even thought of doing this line until mid-season. But like I said, I was feeling so good. I did so much preseason training. I was on top of my game. So by the time they could even like comprehend that I was going to ski this really dicey line day one, I also tipped into it because I was so over eager to, you know, kind of flex on these guys. And I dropped in without really concentrating on what I was about to do. I just took for granted that I would get the job done. And I got off the first rocky cliff thing, not square. I landed all not square. I got over the handlebars. So by the time I went off the second cliff, I had no pop and I was already kind of front flipping on accident, just falling. And I could see all the rocks coming and I was like, oh, I got to stretch out so I don't clip these rocks. And I clip my ass on the rock and I crash and I'm cartwheeling down the mountain, end up face down in the snow. And I'm just like grabbing my ass. I'm like, oh, I just bruised my ass so bad. This is not good. I rolled over onto my back and my leg was draped up across my chest and my boot was up by my head. So I had a noodle of a leg laying on my body. So obviously I didn't know if I shattered my hip and my leg and everything, you know, so I just grabbed my wet noodle of a leg and like plopped it down in the snow where it should be and like piled snow underneath this wet noodle of a leg that was detached from my body. And the only thing I could think of was move your toes. And sure. I like took a couple deep breaths and tried to wiggle my toes and I could. So I was like, okay, this is good news. And I'm like, well, yeah. I'm like, if I start to lose consciousness or things get blurry, it means I probably have internal bleeding. I'm going to die right now. So I was just kind of waiting to see if I'd get, blurred, and I didn't. I stayed sharp. And by then my friends are getting to me and, you know, help starting to arrive and I'm still super alert. Anyway, long story short, I ended up shattering my femur in 11 pieces. Ooh. And several of those bone fragments came within millimeters of nicking my femoral artery, which would have ended things, and you know, could have paralyzed me, all the above. So during that recovery process, you know, I had some pretty serious conversations with myself. Yeah. To keep going down this path of such a dangerous sport, and you know, I concretely, like, no hesitation, like, answered myself that I did. So I made a like very, you know, stern agreement with myself, which was you need to be 100% about what you're doing or you do not do it, like, because you just almost killed yourself, and obviously getting that, you know, intimate relationship with consequences really gave me clarity and gave me a much better decision making abilities, you know. Mm. And so fast forward to, you know, a few years later, when I'm still on that journey and I come back the next year, I start hitting cliffs again and I have that better decision-making ability. I still love skiing. I'm still way into it. I kicked the physical therapy. So I came back 100%. And that in itself was a very interesting journey of all that physical therapy that really took over my whole life for about 5 months. But I got back and so anyway, I'm looking at Jamie Pierre. I'm stuck at this 40-50 foot range. And then, you know, I'm hitting 40 footers like crazy. Like, that's no big deal. I can get there. Yeah. I'm skiing like a champion. I'm having a great time. I'm, you know, a bit more humbled because of what I'd experienced, making better decisions. And things are coming to me. You know, I let things come to me. I'm not trying to just reach out for every possible thing at that point. So from all that, I'm watching the movies. I'm like, how does he hit these big cliffs? And finally, I had this kind of aha moment where I was like, okay, when you hit a 40-foot cliff, you're in the air for maybe a second and a half. And for anyone that's jumped from that height in the water and skis, obviously, you know what that feels like. You see the water, the ground far away, and you have, you know, that second lasts a long time. You have some serious thoughts go through your head. And I realized that for that 1 second, maybe 1.5 seconds, you know, you got a tight body, you have composure, your body mechanics are well thought out, you're prepared, you visualize, and you execute no problem. So I was like, man, if I'm in the air for a second and a half, and that drops me 40-50 feet, I'm like, if I can just have composure for like 0.5 seconds more, that'll probably end up putting me in the 80 to 90 foot cliff range because I'm going to be increasing in speed as I drop. And if I can just maintain composure for another 0.5 seconds,
wow,
that's the key to unlock this. And that really just resonated with me. And I'm the last summer, I'm still just infatuated with going up and hiking up to cliffs in the summer, checking them all out. And really just the 0.5 seconds of composure really resonated with me. And so the next winter comes around, it's January, it's a big winter. I've been starting to hit the 30, 40 footers. And then we're up for sunrise this one morning up on Cardiff across the street from Alta. And we're doing sunrise pattern turn photos. Snow is so deep. Snowpack is bomber. And we're cruising down. And I kind of realized that we're kind of coming up to this rise that looks like a drop. So the group is like, well, yeah, this is like the corner of Hellgate area. So we just got to get around. That's all south facing stuff. And I was like, well, let me go look at what this is. So I kind of crept out to the edge ish of what this looked like, a pretty big cliff. And yeah, sure enough, I get to the point where, you know, it's safe to look and I can kind of see down, and it is just so scary and so big. It's a 90 foot cliff. And it is so scary, and everything in my being is like, you know, evacuate, get out of here. This is dangerous. Yeah. This can harm you. Like, obviously all those bells went off, all the alarms went off of get yourself out of here. This is not a safe place to be. And so obviously everything in me was like, yeah, this is so scary. No way. But then the little like voice in me was like, hey, at least go down there, probe the landing, and just like kind of look at this cliff and see if it just go probe the landing. So I told my group, I'm like, hey, let's ski down and around and probe this thing. And they were all like, absolutely, man, sounds great. Because they knew that I was really interested in big cliffs, and they knew this was a big dog, you know. So they, yeah. You know, it's a powder morning. There's only so much productivity you can have on a morning like that. So them, they were super cool that they were willing to be patient and let me check this thing out, because really, you know, we could have and should have just kept on shooting pow and getting more, stack more photos. But they were like, dude, absolutely. Like, you kidding me? Like, take the time. So yeah. That was cool. So anyway, the landing is so deep. It's just, you know, those days where it's like cartoon deep. It's just, it's nuts. So
yeah,
I'm sitting there probing, and I'm like, then I start to wrap my head around it. I'm like, okay, if I let's just entertain the idea that I hike back up there, man, I hit this cliff. Like, really? Are you gonna? This is safe to land in? So suddenly it became a whole new. The stakes were higher, because usually when you're jumping the 30, 40 foot cliff, and you're in more familiar territory, because most cliffs I hit up to that time were inbounds cliffs that had a long history of people hitting them.
Sure.
With no history of boulders or tree stumps in the landing and stuff like that. So suddenly to go assess a landing in the backcountry just had much larger implications, and it really introduced me to like this whole new level of, you know, assessing something with my life depending on it. So for me to actually probe that landing with the like, okay, this decision you're making right now on how quality the snow is and how deep it is and how steep it is and how, you know, can facilitate, you know, flying through the air for 90 feet and then landing it safely, it became, you know, really intense to come up with that decision. And it was interesting because when I did come up with that decision, it actually like genuinely gave me like this really interesting sense of confidence. And I was like, okay, like I feel this in my bones that I know this landing can facilitate this project. So I was like, all right, guys, I'm gonna hike back up there and have a look. So, you know, obviously willowing through chest deep powder, hiking back up, it takes a little while, takes a lot of energy out of you. So it takes me a good 30 minutes to get back up there, maybe even more. And, you know, I get my skis on and try to get focused, and I start to stamp out again down to the takeoff area, and I go and look off again, and just same thing, all the alarms went off, all the bells were going off, and everything was just like, this is not a safe place to be. get out of here. Like, maybe next time. That's all my body could tell me. It was like, maybe next time, like a different cliff will look better. Like, just get out of here next time, you know? And so yeah. I almost turned my skis just to ski around down where I hiked up to meet up with my friends just to get out of there. And at that moment though, again, something in me was like, dude, if this is the path you're interested in, I just realized right then, I was like, this is never not going to be scary. You're not ever going to be able to magically have some thought or, you know, something that mentally gets you past how scary this is. It's always going to be scary. And if you want to do this, if this is something you're that interested in, you've been thinking about nothing else for the past 3 years of your life, and you've been skiing, you know, 150 days a year, this is like what you want to do in life. Yeah. You need to stare down the barrel. Like, you need to sit with this fear. Like, what's so scary about this? And so I did. I just laid down on my back up there. No one else was up there. And just looked at the clouds and breathed deeply and just started visualizing what I wanted to do. My body mechanics, how much speed I'd have, that composure in the air. And it was interesting because while I did that, my body, my mind did calm down. And I did start to visualize. And all that fear fueled like that critical thinking, and it gave me clarity, because that fear made me realize that there was a way to do it. I did have the skills. I did have the visualization of exactly what I was going to do. And that kind of one path illuminated itself. And I became aware of like how not to do it and the danger of it all. But I put just this path of how to do it became illuminated, and I, you know, was able to convert, as cheesy as it sounds, like all that genuine fear was completely transformed into absolute, genuine, 100% clarity and confidence. And
wow.
Once I got there, I was so calm. I don't know if I've ever been more calm in my entire life up to that point. And I was also very charged with energy, even though I was at a resting heart rate, my breath was very calm. I just had a very, very, very clear focus and intent and love. And I was so part of my surroundings. I felt like I was tapped into like the electromagnetic spectrum of the cliff, the trees, myself, and the ground and the sky.
Wow.
I felt like there was no separation. I could just see it clearly, and I knew I'd be okay. And it was so interesting because in that moment, to tie it back to, you know, my previous injury, I told myself, I was like, wow, you're 100% here. And if you didn't do it, you'd be dishonoring yourself because I'm 100%. So I had absolute confidence, absolute clarity. I had zero fear anymore. Zero. There was no chance of it. Because I always told myself, if you ever have a hair on your body that isn't 100%, you walk away. And not a hair on my body was not 100% about this. I knew I could do it. I knew the exact path. I was totally calm.
Yeah. You know it's going to be life-changing whether you make it or not.
Well, that's the thing. There was no whether or not. It was, I will be successful.
Wow.
There was even a hint of or not, I would walk away. Mm. So I knew had to do what I was going to do. I knew the snow would facilitate it, and I knew I could do it safely. So I called down to my group and I said, hey guys, I'm ready and I'll be hitting it in about a minute. And I put away my radio. I'm doing like final preparation. Of all people, we're in the backcountry. There's another group, and the lead person in that group skis up to me. It's Jamie Pierre.
No way.
Like, oh my God, I'd never met him before. And he kind of sees what I have lined up, and he's like, hey, what's up? He's like, oh, cool, man. He's like, do you mind if I hit this after you? And I was like, that sounds great, man. And he's like, oh, my name's Jamie. I was like, hey, Jamie, what's up? My name's Julian. So he got completely out of the way and respected that, you know, I needed silence and needed to get back into my, focus. And that was a really cool omen that he was there. Yeah. And I just focused, gave my 30 seconds, and, you know, I did exactly what I wanted to do. I got in the air. I've never been more composed in my life. I will say that seeing the ground that far away was otherworldly. I could not make sense of it, you know, how far away the ground was, but I was relaxed. I was calm. And when I came in contact with the snow, I've never been more relaxed. And I tell you what, I had never felt a softer landing in my entire life. I didn't feel a thing because I was so deliberate and so focused and so calm and knew the stakes were so high that I was able to achieve this sense of like relaxation and just awareness to, like I said, coexist with my surroundings. And I mean, I literally didn't feel a thing, and I'm skiing away. I pull off to the side. My friends are going crazy. And I just started laughing to myself because I was like, oh my God, there is no limit. There is no cap on how big I can go. And so the next winter, I ended up hitting like 700 footers, and that 200 footer was one of them. And ever since then, the last 15 years or so, I've hit, you know, at least a 60-foot cliff every single year since that year. And, you know, a few of those winners were like 4 or 5 100 footers. And I think you added it all up, the baseball card stats are pretty intense. But I will say, again, it's never not scary. Even now, I have my protocol down and I've done it hundreds of times. Never ever is it not scary. And it takes everything you've got to focus and to unpack the project, you know, and to see if that path becomes illuminated. Because sometimes obstacles illuminate and you walk away because there's something that's wrong with it, or there's something in your being that day that isn't feeling. I've had to walk away from cliffs way out in the backcountry with filmers all set up and, you know, go out there and probe. Everything's great. I get up there and just everything should work, but not just today. Something doesn't feel good. So I bail. And so, I mean, I've been there too. So it's been a crazy journey, but obviously that topic of fear, man, it's like nuts because it's scary every time. You just have to learn how to sit with it. And I think that's where my skill comes from, is that I've allowed myself to really just face that fear head on and let it be processed. And usually when you do that, the thing that's most scary will present itself. And the thing that's most scary usually is for a good reason. And that's why you're scared you bail. But other times something's scary because it's scary. But you might have the skill set to overcome something that's scary. And I think that's the unique thing of what I've been able to achieve, is how to sit with that fear and be like, okay, I acknowledge that what I'm about to do is super scary, but it doesn't mean I can't do it and get
calm. You're in conversation with fear itself, really.
Absolutely.
You're talking to it like it's an entity.
Absolutely, it is. And that's what's so interesting, because people are like, oh, you're fearless. And it's like, dude, it couldn't be further from the truth. Like, that's so false. Like, it's the exact opposite. Like, right. I have the craziest relationship and interact with fear, potent fear, regularly. You know what I mean? So it is the furthest thing from being fearless, you know?
So I have a question from my wife, Dr. Joy Adams. She's in a band called Big Richard. She's a skier too. And she wants to know, what are you finding in the air that you can't find anywhere else? And is it worth what it costs?
I think that calm mind, that sense of being present, is very rewarding. And I think the most acute, the most concentrated moment of that awareness of, you know, being present, is obviously when you first pop out into the air and you see the ground and possibly far away. I'm completely standstill. you know, it supersedes any other experience that you can have as human, at least that I've had as a human being. I completely escaped the confines of time and Whoa. The ordinary parameters of like the human experience. Cause I'll have these rich, rich thoughts and feelings processed through my mind and my body, in these nanoseconds. And I know that, you know, that it should be impossible to have such a rich experience in a nanosecond, you know. it's greatly rewarding, and it's part of a bigger process, and it's part of a life path I've been on. So, you know, it's all greatly rewarding and certainly worth the, you know, I guess risk mitigation. I just call it, you know, it's like, for me, it's not like a, it's never been like a, I'm going to go out and conquer the mountains. I'm going to slam a Mountain Dew and just send it, bro. It's like a very, very love filled, you know, form of artistry. It's very gratifying, very rewarding, very, very fulfilling. And obviously when I see pictures of it and I'm not in that zone anymore, I just have to laugh because I'm like, that is so crazy. Like, how am I that guy? Like, it's so bizarre that that is my path. And that's kind of my thing, and something I love to do. And it's been very, it's very strange for sure. But, I love the path. I love that I've had to overcome obstacles, and I, you know, I love being out in the mountains with other like-minded people. And at the end of the day, you know, you only have one or two days of winter that you get the luck that the conditions sure. all tie together. Cause that's what's so weird about like cliff jumping into water or off a bridge into water, is that you can go do that
every day. Yeah.
Bridges and waters and all that anytime, any day. But when you're out in the mountains for 150 days a year, those opportunities only present themselves very, very rarely. And I'm just glad that I've decided, like you said, I was on that other end of that riverbank, and I sure didn't want to dip my toe and get carried out into the current. Yeah, yeah. And I did. I went out there and I battled and I made it. And it's so, it feels great to get to the other side, you know, because it was a very intense journey. And like I said, every time I go line up a big cliff, it's never not an intense journey. It takes everything I got, mentally and physically, to get to that level of awareness that I feel that 100% confidence, you know.
Is there any technique you can share that gets you into that mental state, or is it really just the fact that you're so prepared and have thought it through so much?
It really starts with first seeing a cliff. You know, I start immediately developing that relationship with it, whether it's a mile away on a ridge and it looks interesting, or it's one that I've had my eye on for years and like the forecast looks awesome in that area. So we decide to fly out there with the idea of going to check it out. And, you know, obviously we're going to ski a lot besides that, and it might not work out. You know, 99% of the cliffs I've been interested in don't work out. So I just love skiing, luckily. So obviously I'm just going to shred and have a great time with whoever I'm with. And the whole process is just from seeing it and then looking at it, and suddenly it looks like, okay, like this might work. And then you start to look at the landing, you look at the snow, you look at the sheerness, and just through that whole process, you become present. It's like it's an act that gets you into that mindset. It's not really a choice. It's just, as you go through those check marks, you just kind of instinctively start to become aware and get present and really get tapped into your environment. It's just a natural process that kind of evolves as you look at each cliff individually.
Cool. So since Jamie Pierre came up so much in these stories, I just have to share the lesson that I learned from him also when he skied up to it. We skied up to him in the snowbird backcountry, and I knew his voice immediately from all the TGR movies. We were like, dude, like, we don't really know where we're going. Could you just tell us if what's below us is good or if we should keep going? And he was just like, well, you can follow us. There's going to be a bunch of cliffs and pillow lines. It's going to be sick. But quite frankly, you're standing on top of the best powder running of your life. So you could keep traversing or just ski the pow that you're standing on top of. And it taught me, really, you can always keep going, but sometimes realizing that where you're at is somewhere good, and you could just enjoy that. That has really stuck with me every time I'm out. And I'm like, where should we go? Should we keep going?
Wait, I really like that.
It's really good here. This is really good right now, like right below us.
I think that's a good metaphor for life too, because I think we're always trying to overachieve or just be busy for the sake of being busy. And it's like, man, just slow down and enjoy the moment. No matter what that might be, a powder run or relaxing on your deck, drinking a coffee in the morning. Like, there's no reason you need to be busy all the time. There's no reason why you need to overachieve or reach for more than you can. Actually, one of my favorite things that I've always, when kids ask me for advice, I always say, I know that you have the vision to do things that exceed your abilities. I'm like, that's a dangerous parameter. And I'm like, I know, because that's where we all exist when you want to progress and you have to flip at that edge. But I'm like, don't take giant leaps of doing things that you have the vision that you know are way beyond your abilities because you think there might be a miracle. And it might. I'm like, you might pull it off by the skin of your teeth, and then that's great. I'm like, but you're most likely going to encounter a very serious injury if you go by that code of conduct, you know? So I think that quote kind of falls into place with, you know, what's beneath you right now? What's your, you know, what else can you do besides just trying to look for more all the time, you know?
Yeah. Well, Julian, I really appreciate you sharing your time with us, and I want to give you an opportunity to tell people where they can find more about you, where they can support you, can they buy things, protect our winners, anything.
Check out, obviously, my ski stuff and all that on Instagram, probably for all of it, but just my name, Julian Carr. And then I got a pretty cool mountain running race series that I founded, and I race direct in the summer, so check that out. It's at Cirque Series. And I started restoring classic Broncos, so check that out. At Blake.Broncos. And started a retro floor mat company in the truck industry, and that's at Doja Mats.
Nice. The side hustle is real.
Yeah.
No one ever said crossing the river of suck was easy or that you had to do it alone. So I want to thank you for tuning in and giving it a chance. You can join the River of Suck swim team at riverofsuckswimteam.com for just $1 a month. And we really appreciate you being here, Julian Carr. Till next time,
keep swimming.
Yeah, man. Oh, yeah.